All right, so we'll be continuing in our study today, looking at Job's summary defense and starting in Job chapter 29. And we'll see how far we go. There isn't a whole lot that I think I want to really zone in on, especially in chapter 29. Not a whole lot in 30. Chapter 31's got some interesting stuff in it. But of course, let me know if you want me to slow down and we can talk about any of it. We'll work our way through it and see how far we get. Just to get our minds back into it from last week, we talked about chapter 28. I proposed several reasons why chapter 28 might be best understood as an interlude, perhaps by a narrator or something like that. You've got some evidence for that in the text. As we're going to see in chapter 29, verse 1, it says, "And Job again took up his discourse and said," so that implies a break that came before chapter 29. Typically, you see that type of wording when someone else has talked or when there has been a pause or something in between. The content of chapter 28, I think, seems to inform the audience about the rest of the book. It doesn't really flow with what came before or what's going to come after, just from looking at the content of it. It doesn't read like Job. If you read what Job had spoken, it doesn't really sound the way he talks. It doesn't really sound like his friends. And it's not directed at anyone, obviously. It doesn't have a clear audience like a lot of the discourse that came before it, where they're obviously talking to each other, or Job will pause and he'll address God and this type of thing. But rather, it's just kind of like, here's some nuggets of wisdom for you, is how it's presented. So the chapter itself, it talked about the lengths to which man has to go to find these precious gemstones. And we talked about how finding these gemstones is contrasted in the chapter with finding bread, which is relatively simple by comparison. The earth gives that up very easily. But man has to go to the far ends of the earth and dig in the darkness and really put a lot of effort to try to find these gemstones. And what I propose to be the intended difference between those two is the difference between surviving just day to day and then finding a purpose to your life, having something meaningful to live for. You're not going to stumble into meaning in life. It's not going to be obvious. It's something that man would have to dig for, to use the analogy. And I think these gemstones are intended to represent wisdom. So then the chapter addresses how God understands what wisdom is. And where it can be found. The author uses creation as an example, several acts of creation towards the end of chapter 28, and talks about how when God created, he used wisdom and he assigned purpose to the things that he created. He did so very deliberately. It wasn't just a cosmic accident. The earth and the people who populate it are not just a byproduct of something more important, but rather God intentioned them. And he intentioned us to a purpose-filled life. The chapter closes with how God has revealed to man what wisdom is, to fear God and turn away from evil. The implication being that we should choose to listen to God than try to figure out wisdom on our own and by ourselves. With great difficulty, the chapter speaks of finding wisdom. But God has revealed it to us. So that's just a quick overview of what we talked about last week. And we kind of ended the class asking the question, why is this here? Why is this found kind of in the middle? It's found after Job and his friends have kind of gone through this argument, and it's going to come before Job gives his summary. So why might that be? I don't have a great answer. I can speculate a little bit. It could be some reassurance to the reader or the hearer that this is in fact going somewhere. Right, we're not just going to be stuck in this cycle of like one guy says one thing, another guy says another thing, but that it is going somewhere, and that there is wisdom to be found in all of this. It tethers you to how to maybe apply some of what's been said, because a lot of what's been said to this point, I think, has been a mix of right and wrong and good and bad and well thought out and not so well thought out. So it's hard to parse all of that sometimes. And maybe it's reassurance that God is not just going to leave Job and his friends to figure all this out on their own, right? He is going to speak to them. He's going to reveal to them what wisdom is. So his part is yet to come, but it's coming. Were there any other comments or questions about chapter 28 before we move into 29? Yeah, Kelly? Yeah. Yeah. No, good points. And thanks for sharing that. You know, that I agree completely that Job and his friends each had their own set of faulty assumptions, and they were reasoning from those assumptions. I think Job was a little closer to what was going on because he was experiencing what he was experiencing and ready in his mind and his heart, ready to just take it for what it was. Right. He wasn't trying to find something that wasn't there. There is some faulty assumptions going on for both sides there. And, you know, I think that some people can, and they have, walked away from Job thinking, well, God seems kind of flippant about how he treated Job. Almost as if you have a scenario that's kind of like these pagan religions that we talked about a little bit last week, where the gods seemed relatively indifferent towards humans. That any transaction between them was, by some mutual agreement, the people, mankind does this for the God, and so the God will continue to allow the crops grow, right? And you had that transactional relationship. I think chapter 28 is valuable, again, to kind of anchor to us. Like, no, there's something else going on here. It's not that Job was just collateral damage to this conversation between God and Satan, right? There's something else going on here. So, yeah, appreciate that. So let's get into chapter 29. Job is going to give his summary defense in the next three chapters. Chapter 29 is all about how things used to be. Chapter 30 is how they are now, right? How much things have changed. So there's just a contrast set up between 29 and 30. And then chapter 31 is going to be about why Job believes it shouldn't be this way. And it's really him simultaneously giving a defense of himself while also in some cases taking some implied, he's insinuating some things against God in his defense. And he's also bringing curses upon himself to say, like, if I have done this and this and this, then let this happen to me. And he repeats that theme throughout chapter 31. So let's get into it. Chapter 29. We'll start by reading verses 1 through 6. And Job again took up his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness, as I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were all around me, when my steps were washed with butter, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil." So, again, Job just recalling the ways in which God had blessed him in his former days and how he had things pretty good. In verse 7, "When I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew, and the aged rose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and laid their hand on their mouth. The voice of the nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth." So not only did he have things good, but he was very well respected. And I think this is really where Job is going to spend most of his time in chapter 30, when he talks about how things are now, he's really going to hit on this. No one really gives me any respect anymore. They see this has happened to me, and I'm thought of as worse than the worst kind of person that he can imagine. So he had this respect. I think that the idea in verse 8, when it says the young men saw me and withdrew, kind of carries this idea of like giving up one seat for someone else, like someone's coming in and you get out of their way because they are more prominent than you are. So he had this honor. Verses 11 through 17. When the ear heard, it called me blessed, and when the eye saw, it approved, because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I searched out the cause of him whom I did not know. I broke the fangs of the righteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest. I shall multiply my days as the sand. My roots spread out to the waters with the dew all night on my branches. My glory fresh with me and my bow ever new in my hand. So in verse 11, he starts by talking about why people respected him. He said, when the ear heard, it called me blessed, and the eye saw it approved, because, and then he goes through all these things that he did, talking about how people respected him because of all the works that he did. They saw him walking the walk, and because they saw him walking the walk, they listened to what he had to say. They respected his words for that. Like in verse 13, the blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me. Job would take upon himself the responsibility of helping the person who was about to perish. I think in these verses you see how proactive he was. He wasn't waiting for someone to come tell him there was a need, but he was out searching the matter out. He even says that in verse 16, right? I searched out the cause of him whom I did not know. He's looking, he's out actively seeking for ways to help people. And in verse 17, very descriptive, I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. This idea, these people who are caught up, they're being abused or taken advantage of by someone more powerful than them, like a predator has caught its prey, but he broke their fangs, right? He rescued them from the mouth of those who were going to consume them. And it also implies that he's got considerable power and influence to be able to do this too, right? He's able to render those predators not able to do much anymore without their fangs. And then in verses 18 through 20, he talks about how he shall die in his nest and multiply his days in the sand. His roots will spread out to all the waters and the dew all night on my branches. Just all these images about how secure he felt in this arrangement, how he believed that God's blessings would continue upon him, it would continue upon his family after him, that his roots would spread far. He knew and trusted that God would provide for him because he was providing for others. And I know we have to be careful about how much practical application we take from some of this stuff, because Job's got a very specific reason why he's bringing all this up, right? He's defending his integrity against his friends. Do you think it's wrong for us to take a similar approach to say, I believe God will provide for me because I'm trying to provide for other people? What do you think, Sean? Right.
So being humble and being righteous is not in conflict, or it's in harmony with what he's saying. So whenever he was acting as this kind of individual, he realized, I have respect, people view me as wise, and I kind of know it. I mean, essentially, I don't know how you would, to me it seems pretty clear. arrogant.
Right.
In that, and he believed also, and this is probably going to answer your question, going to be the outcome of this also. I have blessed, and his goodness will probably bless me as well. And I don't think that means that it was, again, a contract between him, but it was also just a reality. Like, I don't serve God just to get to heaven, but I believe that God will reward me.
Yeah.
And so I'm just thinking, more than anything, that really sticks out in this chapter, that he acknowledged all of these things, and that didn't make him a bad guy.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I that's how I see it, too. That's not how I think people who are listening to Job say these things are going to perceive it. I think they hear him say these things and they think, oh man, he thinks he's the greatest thing that ever walked the earth. Listen to how prideful he is. But I think Job is not intending to come across prideful, but I think he is caught up in the moment of defending himself. And I think that he is aggressively pursuing his accuser, saying, what do you have on me? Here's everything I can tell you about myself. Bring it on. What do you have? What of substance do you have to accuse me with? And I think that's the context in which he's offering all these things that he's done. He's not just bragging, right? That's not his intention. But again, I think his friends are going to perceive it as that way. Yeah, Billy? Yeah. Yeah. And I would argue even some physical assurances, too. God has said he would provide for us. And I think your point is well made. We have to walk a line between presuming upon God and thinking that we're entitled to all that he's done for us. But also having confidence that he is doing it. And some of it is very clearly contingent upon how we're conducting ourselves. And I think about what came to my mind was 2 Corinthians chapter 9 in verse 6. I think this principle is even in play today and in the New Testament. 2 Corinthians 9, 6, the point is this: whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. And the verse where it talks about God's going to provide seed for the sower, right? So God's going to see that if you have the willingness to help other people out, we have these verses that talk about how he's going to give us a way to do that. It doesn't mean that we've got millions of dollars coming our way, and it doesn't mean we've got assurances of financial security for the entire duration of the rest of our lives, but God's going to see to it that his workers are going to have what they need to get the job done. I think we have those assurances. So I think that that's more along the lines of what Job is talking about. He was blessed by God richly, and he put those blessings to good use. And God saw that, and God said, that's good. I approve of that. And you have God's endorsement of him again, in the first couple of chapters as he's doing it. Yeah, Sean?
Just along with some of these things that he
Yeah, good point.
I mean, there is some things you're like, oh, I didn't realize what you talked about talent. Oh, I don't really know that I have that talent. Well, you do. You know you do. And so it can go to a false humility side.
Right.
But again, I mean, anyways, that was just another thought that I had.
That's a great point. It fits so well with what Job keeps saying, is that I'm not going to say something false. You know, for good or bad, look at where it's gotten me, right? But I'm not going to speak falsehood, even if it means that my friends are going to continue to slander me and people are going to continue to think poorly of me. I'm not going to say something that's false. Yeah, Kelly? Right. Yeah, we should take his blessings and not feel guilty about doing it. Right. I don't think he wants us to feel guilty about being blessed by him. And there's a difference between humility and guilt. Yeah, Rod? Well taken. We shouldn't, again, like presume that we're entitled to any of this. And I think that's where you're going with verse 18, is maybe Job kind of thought this is just how it's going to be. Maybe there was a little bit of entitlement there. I'm not sure. We need to be careful about that. And we need to be careful, too, that we don't fall into this way of thinking that just because someone has good things, that means that God approves of them. That's not it at all. And I think Job actually argues against that quite a bit. He calls his friends out on their hypocrisy by saying that when things were good for me, you listened to what I had to say. Now that all this calamity is falling upon me, I'm like the dumbest person you ever met, right? And I'm in rebellion. That shouldn't be the case. Listen to what I'm saying. Don't look at what happened to me, but listen to my words. So all good thoughts, lots of stuff for us to take away and think about. Verses 21 through 25, back in Job chapter 29, as we close the chapter. Job says, "Men listened to me and waited and kept silence from my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again, and my word dropped upon them. They waited for me as for the rain." It does sound a little arrogant. I wouldn't say that, I hope. "And they opened their mouths as for the spring rain. I smiled on them when they had no confidence, and the light of my face they did not cast down. I chose their way and sat as chief, and I lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners." So again, back to this idea of all the respect that people had for Job and for what he had to say. They would listen to him, and that's set up in stark contrast to what he's been trying to say to his friends throughout this whole time, is you're not listening to me. Right, you're seeing this the way you're seeing it, but you're not hearing what I'm saying. I hear what you're saying. I can put myself in your position. And in some cases in the chapters we've already covered, I can recount to you back all the arguments that you've made against me as a way of showing that I know where you're coming from, but that you're not where I am, and you're not hearing me on that. Back before all this happened, people would hear him. And not just in the sense of like they would consider what he had to say, but that it was like kind of the final word in a lot of matters. I mean, they really esteemed what he had to say very, very highly. So it's interesting that he focused on this so much, on this respect that he used to have. And I think that one of the tendencies that I had, and I don't know if this is common, but people can read these verses and they can think of like, man, Job seems so hyper-focused on his own integrity, on his own respect, that he's talking about the good old days, he's talking about when he would walk into the room and people would sit down and listen to him, and he barely even mentions his kids, right? He mentions them a little bit, and people can say, well, maybe his priorities were out of balance, and maybe so. Maybe you can say that. But I think that I don't quite go there. I think that the reason he's focusing so much on people listening to him and respecting him is because that's what's pertinent in this conversation. His friends aren't listening to him. They aren't respecting him. And he's trying to convince them, here's why you should. So whatever it's worth. Chapter 30. We have the turn now. The good old days versus where we are now. Verse 1, but now they laugh at me, men who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. He's got away with words sometimes. These young men aren't giving up their seats for Job anymore, right? Since this happened, and Job's going to argue that even the worst of them are esteemed as more respectable than Job is now. Something that's interesting to me when I think about what I'm going to read here in chapter 30 is how public it seemed Job's struggles were. It seemed like everybody saw this. Like it wasn't just happening to him in his house and only a few people knew about it. It seemed like this was like the topic of conversation in his area. People saw this and they had an opinion on it. And their view towards Job had shifted dramatically, and not just that of his three friends. If what we read is true from what Job says. Yes.
Do you think that things like this, that this could have been a really long time then, that these, could there have been a good amount of time and these guys have come back together, these are like several conversations that could have happened, and now he's actually seeing the application of how people are treating him? Because, you know, I've wondered, like, the young man, like, who would that be if all this happened?
Yeah, it could be, and that could be an explanation for why in the previous three or four chapters we had seen, and Job again took up his discourse. Whenever you see that, typically it indicates there's some break of some kind. Either someone else talked or there's some time between. So it could be there's some passage of time that happened. I do think by this time they had an audience. I think it's not just Job and his three friends, and I think Elihu is speaking from that crowd, I believe. That's how I read it. And I've got some thoughts on Elihu. I'm not sure what to think about him, but I wonder if there's a little bit of irony that maybe Elihu plays the role of this man who's younger than him, whose fathers would not have disdained to put the dogs in my flock. Elihu's got a lot to say, as we're going to see. And we'll talk through some reasons why. Is what he's saying profitable? Is it accurate or is it not? And that's, if you ever talk with someone about Job, that's almost always the first thing that comes up. What do you think about Elihu? Andy, do you think he was saying what was right or not? So we'll look at some of that. But the stage is being set for Job to talk about how much it bothers him that these younger, unqualified people are now looking at him like he's worthless. And then here you have young Elihu step up and talk for six chapters. It's kind of funny. I think that you have evidence that what happened to Job was public, and there could have been a couple of breaks in between this conversation. It could have been picked up a little bit later. So let's look at verses 2 through 10. Job chapter 30. Job continues, "What could I gain from the strength of their hands, men whose vigor is gone? Through want and hard hunger, they gnaw at the dry ground. By night, in waste and desolation, they pick stalwart in the leaves of bushes and the roots of the broom tree for their food. So he's talking about people who are outcasts, perhaps even insane, right? They've been outside where civilization is, and they're doing crazy things like eating dirt, okay? They are driven out from human company in verse 5. They shout after them as after a thief. In the gullies of the torrents they must dwell, in holes of the earth and in the rocks, among the bushes they bray, under the nettles they huddle together, a senseless, a nameless brood. They have been whipped out of the land. And now I have become their song. I am a byword to them. They abhor me. They keep aloof from me. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me. So I think this is Job's best attempt to describe the most detestable of human conditions. People who are just not reasonable in their mind at all, who are doing crazy things like eating roots and dust. And they look upon Job and they say, well, at least I got it better than that guy, right? That's how bad Job has come in his own esteem. Continuing on, because God has loosed my cord and humbled me, they have cast off restraint in my presence. On my right hand, the rabble rise. They push away my feet. They cast up against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. I think by promoting the calamity, they're like saying he deserves it, or they're spreading it around, maybe like gossip. They need no one to help them. As through a wide breach they come, amid the crash they roll on. Terrors are turned upon me. My honor is pursued as by the wind, and my prosperity has passed away like a cloud. So, again, these individuals now who normally nobody would listen to are now a stumbling block for Job, and they seem to be making things worse for him, perhaps believing or saying false things that have been said about him. And I'll just offer a commentary on, if you've ever been in a situation where you've seen someone accused, or you yourself have been accused of things that aren't true, the sheer quantity of words, even if there's no quality to them, can wear you down. It can get in your head, and it can upset you and get you into a bad disposition, a bad mood, a bad state, and it's hard to just block all that negative chatter out, even if there's nothing to it. Even if you know the things that are being said about this person are not true, or if they're being said about you, if they're not true, the sheer quantity can overwhelm you sometimes and really affect your disposition. And I think maybe that's what Job had experienced here. He knows they got nothing on him. He's going to continue to challenge them. But he's overwhelmed by it's coming at him from every direction, right? It's just overwhelming to him. Starting again in verse 16. And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With great force my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like the collar of my tunic. God has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. So I'm just talking about the physical pain and the toll it's taken on his body here. In verse 20, turns his attention to God, I believe, here. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind, you make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. So Job's talking here about how God is refraining from helping him or showing any evidence of even sympathizing for him, having any pity on him. The image here being like someone in great need crying out to another person, help me, and they just stand there looking at him like blank face, no emotion, nothing, no action, no help, no evidence of any pity at all. That's what he's perceiving from God in his direction. verse 24, he says, "Yet does not one in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand and in his disaster cry for help? Did I not weep for him whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? But when I hoped for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came." So Job's questioning, he's asking rhetorically, is it wrong for me to ask for help? You know, is that why I should have received no help, because I shouldn't have asked? And he's saying, but I did, right? He reasons that when others came to him for help, he helped. And he didn't just help in a very stoic manner. Like he mourned for them, right? He cared. He showed pity to them. And not this image of what he paints to be what he perceives coming from God, which is that of cruelty and indifference. And he's saying, I did this for them. You know, why wouldn't it come back, you know, why wouldn't it come back to me the same way? Verse 27, "My inward parts are in turmoil and never still. Days of affliction come to meet me. I go about darkened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I am a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. My skin turns black and falls from me, and my bones burn with heat. My lyre is turned to mourning, and my pipe to the voice of those who weep." So this is just summarizing the extent of Job's suffering, and as we've seen, it was horrific what he was going through. Verse 28 is a little unclear to me when he says, "I go about darkened, but not by the sun." King James Version renders it quite differently. It says, "I went mourning without the sun. I stood up and I cried in the congregation." So that rendering of it makes more sense to me than what the ESV has. And sometimes when that happens, I wonder if maybe there's some wordplay going on here that's lost in translation, because it makes it difficult for the translators to get the meaning perfectly, because there's probably like more than one meaning intended, right? So there could be some wordplay happening here in the Hebrew that we miss. So we're not going to have time to cover chapter 31 in its entirety, but just to kind of give a summary of it, and then we'll get into it. I'm sorry again, I didn't send out a write-up this week, but I'll try to send one out next week, or this week ahead of us, rather. But chapter 31, again, it's basically going to be about Job cursing himself if he is in fact guilty of any sin. And as we already talked about, I don't read this as Job trying to be prideful. I read it as him trying to be aggressive in his defense, trying to convince his friends that you have nothing on me. Here's all the evidence I bring to the table about my character and my integrity. What evidence do you bring that contradicts that? And they're not able to bring any. So I think that's really what it's going to be about, even though we know that it seems apparent, to at least to Elihu, that he's being arrogant. Once we get to Elihu's response that starts in chapter 32. Again, as you're going through this, in Job 31 especially, for some reason, I've seen it used as examples of, or well, practical examples, I guess, of godly living. You know, there's an app that helps helps keep people accountable if they have a pornography addiction, called Covenant Eyes. And this is the verse that it goes off of. In verse 1, it says, "I had made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin?" Like, that's the basis of their whole business model, right? How they got the name that they got. And I think that you can look at Job's life and you can say, yeah, that was a good guy. He did a lot of righteous things. But as always, understand these contexts first, these verses first and foremost in their context. This is Job aggressively defending his integrity. He's challenging his friends to bring something of substance against him. And it's not just Job offering up advice for how to live well. So just take it for what it's worth. I'm not saying that we can't learn anything from how Job behaved, but understand the context before you go somewhere. I probably wouldn't go to Job 31 to try to convince people here's how you should live any more than I would go to Job 25 when Bildad talks about God's authority and say, here's my basis for why God has authority. Well, yeah, a lot of what Bildad says is true, but Bildad's also trying to falsely accuse Job in what he's saying. So just context, right? Context is very important. We're about out of time. Sorry I didn't get into chapter 31, but are there any final comments or questions? Yeah, David? Yeah, and I agree with you on that. You know, I would say if someone asked me, what do you think about Job, the character Job? He was a great man. I don't think there's anyone his equal when it came to righteousness. God even, I mean, when you have God's endorsement to that degree, who am I to disagree? I don't think he handled himself as well as he could have in this exchange. I think that he's got some faulty assumptions, as we talked about, and he's insinuating some things against God. And a lot of what he says, if it isn't correct, it is dangerous. You know, things like, you know, what difference does it make if you're righteous or not? God's going to treat you the same way. I mean, he literally says that, you know, back in chapter 9.
I mean,
but
specifically in that text, obviously.
But I think what I want to come back around to, though, is your point is it's very important for us to think about. I think it really informs how I read Elihu's response, because Elihu is condemning Job for all the same things, basically, that his friends did. Let's keep in mind that Job didn't get this because he deserved it, because he committed some sin. He was a righteous man. Let's hold that in mind. Let's hold that in mind, that he had God's endorsement. And even though he didn't handle himself well, and I think he in some ways, he threw fuel on the fire, right, and a lot of the things that he said. Because at this point, he was just kind of like, whatever, you know. But yeah, let's keep that in mind. I think that's important to keep that in mind as we read Elihu. It informs what I think of Elihu, actually, when remembering that Job is a good man. If Job were guilty of the things that Elihu said, I may feel differently. But he isn't, right? All right, thank you so much for your comments and for your attention today.